Today is the anniversary of the appearance in this world, the birth in this world of, you see the portrait over there, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And he is the guru or spiritual master of Srila Prabhupada, who founded the Hare Krishna movement internationally. Of course, the Hare Krishna movement is part of eternal religious principles. We could also say it's part of the movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu 500 years ago, but Srila Prabhupada brought it to the world, and he is the disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta. So we understand Evam Param Pratam Imam Rajasya Vidim Sakalaya Himata Yoganasta Vrantabhav. That knowledge, parampara, means one has to go after another. I mean, even in ordinary life, there's a teacher who has a student, and that student becomes a teacher who has a student who becomes a teacher. If you want to learn anything, you want to learn mathematics, you want to learn how to fix a car engine, you have to learn from somebody who learned from somebody. And the original teacher has to be the manufacturer, right? So they'll train you up, some company, they'll train you how to fix something, how to do something, and then you train others. So the original guru is God himself. And then he has disciples, Brahma, Lakshmi Devi, and they have disciples, and whenever the chain gets broken, again the Lord or one of his representatives has to come and fix things. Just like any university, the government has some sort of accrediting system, isn't it? And they keep checking. It's not just that one time they say, okay, now you're legitimate and you can do whatever you want. But they periodically check on them. And if they're off track, then they have to get back on track. So we can trace, just like we have in our Bhagavad Gita, the beginning of our Bhagavad Gita, we have a line of disciplic succession. Thank you. So here's a line of teacher and student going back to the beginning of creation. Now, of course, there couldn't be only this few, because the creation's been around a long time. So this is just noting the major teachers. We're not listing every single person in that line. And this is particularly a line of what we call shiksha, or instructing teachers and their disciples. So Bhaktisiddhanta is very important for those of us who are following the Krishna consciousness movement. Because one of the things he did, for example, was allow what, in his day, was modern technology to be used in spreading spirituality. He also allowed for some materialistic persons to give help to his society. It wasn't just a closed society of only very serious spiritual seekers. So by doing these two things, by opening up his society for people to come in and contribute, even if they weren't that spiritually serious, and by using modern technology, he had four printing presses. He opened the door to being able to bring spirituality to the mass of people. If in order to be spiritual, you had to go to the Himalayas and live in a cave and just bathe in the freezing cold Ganges, then how many people would do it? And then we're just kind of lost. Now, he was born in 1874. And he was a very unusual person, even from a material point of view. He had a photographic memory. It was called a living encyclopedia. And he got top grades in all of his school classes without ever having to study. One thing he did is he unified the four great schools of theistic thought in India, called the four sampradayas. He did this by publishing works of teachers in other schools, and also by writing materials showing unification. So he was somebody who sought to unify rather than divide. He also established 64 temples in India, and one in Germany, one in London, and one in Rangoon. So So he was starting to bring this transcendent knowledge, which has long been associated with India, to people of the whole world. And I'd like to focus today, and we could focus on so many things from Bhaktisiddhanta, I'd like to focus on one story that he told. Now, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati was very famous for teaching through stories. Not necessarily true stories, but more like fables, allegories. So this is one that he told that I thought would be very helpful for us to meditate on. By chance, a person slipped and fell into a deep well and could not get out in spite of all his efforts. Therefore, he began shouting for help. Being merciful, a very kind-hearted passerby brought a piece of long rope, which was lowered down in the well so that the man could get out by grabbing the rope. The passerby asked the man to catch hold of the rope and try to climb up on it so he could pull him out. In response, the person started shouting, "Oh, my friend, please help me so that I can put my fingers around the rope." And in commenting on this story, Bhaktisiddhanta said that it's only by our earnest effort in catching hold of the mercy that we can attain enlightenment. That unless we extend our best efforts earnestly and qualify ourselves for mercy, it is next to impossible to be rescued from our fallen condition. So in looking at this allegory, we first have to consider that we are in a well. So in this regard, now this is an allegory, but now I can tell you a true story. There's this woman who was a very expert hiker and climber, professional level, and she was visiting some friends in Hawaii. She decided she was going to go for a walk. And sometimes when you're very good at something, you may think you're so good at it that you don't do what you know you're supposed to do. You ever done that? You're so expert at something that you think, well, I'm already expert. I can skip some of the basic stuff. So she went out for a walk along the coast, and she didn't tell anybody where she was going. I mean, just a simple walk along the beach. What would be the problem? And as she's walking along the beach, there's a woods next to her, and she sees various paths going through the woods, and there's one that parallels the beach, and she thinks, oh, that would be nice. I'll get to just walk in the shade and see the natural plant life and etc. and still have the ocean here. So she's walking along, and as she's walking, at a certain point she realizes that she can't see the ocean anymore and that she's gotten lost in the woods. And thinking that she was right by the ocean, and this is a true story, she didn't mark her path because she thought, oh, I'm right by the ocean. And she tried to retrace her steps, but it was very complicated. And at a certain point, she realized that she was hopelessly lost, and it was getting to be the afternoon. So then she saw a little hill, and she thought, well, if I go up on the hill, then I can get a good view of the different paths. And by seeing the different paths, I can find my way back. So she had a pack with her, with water and food and a torch and all that kind of thing. Again, she was a professional climber and hiker. And as she starts to go up this hill, she realizes that it's steeper than she had anticipated, and she puts her pack down. And as she's going up the hill, at a certain point she realizes that she's not going to be able to come back down the way that she went up, that it was too steep. So she gets to the top, and she sees she can't come down the other side either. And the top is so narrow that she can't even lie down on it without risking falling off. Meanwhile, it's getting to be nighttime, so she can't sleep up there because she may just fall off this little ridge. And she doesn't have any water, and she doesn't have a flare, and she doesn't have any food. So, and she didn't tell anybody where she was going. So she's up there having to force herself to stay awake, and, you know, it was comfortable at night, but in the daytime with the hot sun on her, it was quite hot. She was very thirsty, and she's having to stay awake. Of course, meanwhile, her relatives start to look for her, but they don't know where she went. And after 3 days up there, then she started saying, God, why did you put me in such a position? And then all of a sudden she realized, no, I put myself here. Of course, she was eventually rescued by a helicopter, or I wouldn't be able to tell you the story. But this is actually our position. I mean, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati gives the allegory of falling into a well. But in other words, getting in some position that we got into somehow or other by our own foolishness, and now we can't get out. So what is this position? This position is that, first of all, we have this material body. We are different from this body. Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, Ajo Nitya Shasvato Yam Purano Nahanyate Hanyamane Shavire, that we are a spiritual being. We are eternal. We never die. We can't be injured by any weapon. We can't be burned up. We can't be drowned. We can't be harmed in any way. We're an eternal being, a part of God. Mamai Vamso Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. We're a little fragment of God. Not a fragment in the sense that God's been cut into fragments and he doesn't exist anymore, but a fragment in the sense that your child is a part of you, genetically speaking. But you're complete and your child is complete. You didn't have to lose a finger or something. Not like that. So we're all a part of God in that sense. We're all spiritual beings. And yet we've taken on this material body. Why have we taken on this material body? Karanam guna sangasyat. We've associated with what's called the modes of material nature. Just like somebody may not see a well, they're thinking, I'm just going to explore, and they fall into an unused well. Or this woman was thinking, let me see the sights in the forest, and not realize that she got off track. So we become attracted by these modes of material nature, which are something like the three lights that produce an image on a screen. So these modes of nature are goodness, passion, and ignorance. Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. Sattva means goodness, also means truth, it also means reality. But it's not ultimate reality. It's desire for salvation, liberation, purity, not ultimate spiritual purity. Anyway, these three lights playing on the screen of material nature create this phantasmagoria that we call material existence. And being attracted by them and being in association with them, we developed material desires, which got us a material body. Each of the bodies that we have is meant to fulfill a certain kind of desires. It is also the result of our past karma, which is two different ways of saying really the same thing. Karma is what I do, and what I do is according to what I desire. Does that make sense? What I do is according to my real desire. It's not according to what I say I want. Just like if you study an organization, you can tell what their priorities are by how they spend money. You can usually tell that in a family too and in our own life. We can say, this is what's really important to me. But if you want to know what's really important to us, not just what we say, then how do you spend your money? How do you spend your time? Isn't it? You know, that's what's actually important to us. So in the same way, karma is a demonstration of our desires. It's a tangible demonstration of what we want. If someone says, I really want to become a medical doctor, and they sit all day watching television, then they don't really want to become a medical doctor. You know, a little bit, maybe, but not very much. So our desires as exemplified by our actions. And of course, sometimes we don't really know what to desire. And that's the problem. If each of us look at the body we have now, the life we have now, is anyone here going to say it's all perfect? Anybody? Anybody look at the mirror and go, yes, exactly. Or our personality. You know, if we look at our personality, are we exactly the kind of person we'd like to be? You know, those of us who are really shy, we think, maybe if I could be more outgoing. Those of us who are really outgoing, we think, maybe if I could be a little bit more shy. You know, just whatever we have, right? Those of us who are very straight-talking, we might think, boy, it'd be nice if I could be more tactful sometimes. And people who are tactful think, funny, I could just speak out more. You know, those of us who are really cautious, we think, finally, I'd be willing to take some risks sometimes. And those of us who are risk-takers, we think, next time I wish I could just take a little bit more time to investigate what I was going to do. So looking at our personalities also in this life, at our bodies, at our personalities, we may say, it's not quite what I want. And then the circumstances of our life, what family we were born into, how much money we have, how much education we have, the decisions that we've made in our lives, the kind of lives we've built for ourselves. You know, is it exactly what we wanted? Most of us would look at our life and say, I should have made that decision, and maybe I should have done that, and I don't know if I'm so happy with this. And right? But all of that is the result of our material desires. Our material desires in previous lives and our material desires in this life. Actually, this body is this body, and the mind we have, the personality we have in this life, this is simply the manifestation of our desires. And then sometimes, you know, we may say, all right, well, instead of just trying to get a better or different material situation, why don't I come to spiritual life instead? When one's in material life, one thinks, let me just adjust the material situation. Let me get a different kind of body. Let me get a different kind of personality. Let me build a different kind of life. And we try in this life, and when that doesn't work out, then we get another life. That's why we take life after life, you know. Because we're thinking, if only I could do this, if only I could do that, if only I had this, if only I had that, if only I was like this, if only I was like that. And we, our actions, we're working toward those things. So again, okay, give it a try. Give it a go. Try this life. Try that life. Oh, maybe if instead of a woman, I was a man. Maybe instead of a man, if I was a woman. Maybe instead of being American, if I were German. Maybe if I could be taller or shorter. Maybe if I could, you know, be more outgoing. Maybe if I could do this. Maybe if I were only a musician. If I could have done that. But an intelligent person says, wait a minute. Maybe if I could just get out of this jungle. Not just take this path or that path. But maybe if I could actually get out. Maybe if I could get out of the well. Maybe if I could stop taking material bodies one after another with this personality and that personality and this nationality and this thing and the other thing. So then one seeks for something different. One seeks then for enlightenment. One seeks for realization of the ultimate self. One seeks for realization of my source, the ultimate spiritual self. But we find that we can't get there just by our own endeavor. You know, somehow or other, we worked ourselves to the bottom of the well or the top of a hill, and we're stuck there. We don't know how to get out. So at that point, we say, I need some help. I can't do this by myself. I mean, we can try that for a while, too. People try that. They try their own process of enlightenment. I mean, especially nowadays, nobody wants to follow any sort of teacher, any sort of institution, or any sort of authority. We have a very anti-authority culture. Nobody wants to join an organized religion. You know, after I joined the Hare Krishna movement, after a while I realized, if I joined an organized religion, that wasn't what I wanted to do. So we may think, okay, let me be just sort of eclectic. Okay, I can take a little bit from this religion and a little bit from that and a little bit from this teacher and a little bit from that teacher and do some little practices and put some little crystals up in my house and get some little angel statues and do my own little kind of meditation. And that way, I'll realize myself and get out of this cycle of birth and death. Of course, if we do that, then we're having ourselves as an authority. Isn't it? But that doesn't work very well. And therefore, if we really want to get out, we have to go to the person who sees the whole maze. I like that woman wanting to get up on a hill to see everything. You have to have someone who can really see everything, who can understand the process of entanglement and understand the process of release. For although we got ourselves into the mess, we can't get ourselves out of it. Isn't that often the case? You get yourself in a mess and you need somebody else to get you out of it. So that's our situation. And the beginning of the spiritual path is realizing that that's my situation. That I can't get myself out just by my own efforts. I don't even exactly know how. I know that I'm not satisfied with material life. I know that I'm tired of taking birth after birth. I know that I'm tired of looking for a kind of eternal, unlimited, ever-existing, ever-new happiness that I don't find in my material activities and my material relationships. I know I want to live forever with eternal, vibrant life. I know I want to have actual knowing. I was reading a theory by this, a theory on management by these people at MIT, and they were saying how that managers have a really hard time making decisions that are going to achieve the results they want. And so what they need to do is come to a deep level of knowing, actual understanding, actual realization. So we know we want that, but we don't achieve that just by taking one class after another, reading one book after another. So we may know that we want this, but who is going to help us find this? At a certain point, we just sort of say, help, like the guy at the bottom of the well. No. Somebody, help me. So our source, Krishna, the ultimate, unlimited, spiritual being of whom we are a part. So he hears that cry for help. He was just waiting for that. And those of us who have parents, sometimes your children try to do something and you offer to help them and they say, no, I want to do it myself. And so you wait. And then when they say, can you please help me? And then you come in. So Krishna is waiting for us to say, help. And then he comes himself, or he sends one of his agents. So this is the meaning of guru. Actually, the only guru is God. The only guru is God. We say the guru is a transparent vayant medium. So a guru is a person who is acting as a conduit. For those of us who we can't hear the voice of God directly to help us, we say it's the external manifestation of the Lord. And we have the guru within the Lord, and then we have his representative. So he sends one of his representatives to help us. And then we are told, okay, it's not that you're entirely helpless. Yes, you need help, but you're not entirely helpless. It's a dual effort. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati is giving the analogy of throwing the rope down in the well. It's also the case when this woman was rescued by a helicopter, that the helicopters, they sent down some sort of rope or some sort of chair thing, and she had to get into it. Now you have to somehow or other hold on. There's something you have to do. You have to at least make yourself available. You know, sometimes in the water when you rescue a drowning person, they don't have the strength to hold on, but at least they have to, like, let go. If they're fighting you, what can you do? You can't bring them in. There has to be some level of cooperation with the process. So this is what he's describing, this cooperative effort to get out of illusion between ourselves, the soul, and between the guru and God. This story is also very nicely explained when Krishna's mother, Yasoda, was trying to correct him for taking some butter. And just like nowadays we have, I don't know what you call them here, but in America we call them playpens. Do you know what those things are? It's a place where children can play, but it has sides on it. It has usually like a railing or a screen of some sort. So the child can play in this area, but not get out. So not they won't cause any mischief. It's like a safe place for them to play. So in those days, they didn't have playpens, and what they would do, you see sometimes, at least in America, sometimes when people take their children out shopping, they put a kind of harness on them with a lead. Have you seen that?
Yes.
So Mother Yasoda was trying to put this sort of thing on Krishna, because he was causing a lot of mischief. Sweet mischief, of course. But she couldn't do it, because Krishna doesn't have any inside or outside, and he's unlimited. Ananta rupa means he has unlimited forms, it also means his form is unlimited. Actually, when Yasoda had looked in his mouth previously, she saw all the universe. How do you tie up the universe? So she's trying to put this tie around and she can't do it. And she gets another rope, and again, she keeps tying all these ropes so that they're, you know, it's longer than this room. And she couldn't even put this rope on this little child. Right? And then finally, after she tried and tried and tried, he allowed her to put the rope on. So this is one story also about this relationship between effort and mercy. So many of us wonder, all right, if I want to become enlightened, is it just an act of grace? Is it just that I kind of go through life and then all of a sudden I wake up one day and I'm enlightened? That would be nice. Maybe. But maybe not, because then who decides who gets enlightened or not? Is it just some sort of whimsical thing? You know, is it just that there's some God who closes his eyes and throws out little, you know, enlightenment sparks, and whoever they happen to hit just becomes enlightened, and everybody else has to suffer in karma and reincarnation? That wouldn't be very nice. Who would like to have such a God as the ultimate reality? Reminds me of the stories of the different gods in Greek and Roman thought. They're very capricious, very whimsical. Oh, I think I'll be nice to this one. Oh, I think I won't be nice to this one. At the same time, we see that just our own effort, we're blind. We're in illusion. We're not able to do it. So what is it? It's that effort is rewarded with grace. And we see this again even in material things. You know, I was a teacher for many years, and if a student has trouble with something, you always ask them to try first before you help them. If someone comes and says, can you help me with this? We say, have you tried? Have you tried to figure it out? And you work with them, and you give them advice as they're working. Why is that? Why do we need effort? Not because our effort can get us to enlightenment, not because our effort can get us to love of God, but because our effort shows that it's something that we really want. Just like materially speaking, what we really want is shown by what we do, and that's the key to our karmic reactions. You know, you can say anything, but it's what you do that demonstrates your desire. So in spiritual life, it's very similar. You know, anybody can say, yes, I'd love to see Krishna dancing in the groves of Vrindavan, or I'd like to see Krishna on the battlefield with Arjuna, or I'd like to see Krishna lifting up the Govardhan mountain, and I'd love to enter into the eternal activities of the spiritual world. I'd love to realize that I'm a spiritual being and get free of this cycle of reincarnation. But will you do anything about it? No. I'm just waiting for it to happen. So then, obviously, our so-called intention is not very strong. It's not very meaningful. Isn't it? I mean, if some friend said to you, oh, I'd love to really do something for you, but they never actually do anything for you, what does it mean? You know? Like sometimes people will say to me, Armila, why don't you come to my house sometime for dinner? And I used to think, well, I can't say yes because then I'll have more dinner engagements than I can go to. But I found out I could say yes because for most people, nothing ever happened. It was only when someone said, can you come Wednesday at 6 o'clock, that anything happened. Otherwise, it was meaningless. Oh, we'd love to have you over. I'd say, sure, I'd love to come over. So it's something like that when we say, I'd love to be enlightened. But when we say, okay, I'm going to spend some time every day absorbed in kirtan. I'm going to spend some time every day chanting the holy name. I'm going to spend some time every day studying the scriptures. I'm going to spend my time in the association of other spiritually minded persons. I'm going to be determined to get rid of some bad habit that's keeping me from spiritual life. I'm going to do something to teach other people about spirituality, and then do it. Maybe not perfectly, but do it. Actually make the effort. And then the grace comes. And as we get grace, then we can do more. And as we do more, it's not really that what we do gives us enlightenment. But it shows our sincerity. It shows that we really don't want to cultivate any more material desires. Because after all, Krishna is very responsive. He's not going to force spiritual unlimited bliss on someone who doesn't want it. And you might say, why would anyone not want it? But I'm afraid that materially conditioned souls don't want it. Because there's a price for unlimited eternal bliss in loving relationships with Krishna. And the price is that I can no longer think that I'm the master and controller of the world. That's the price. So the reality is that not everybody is willing to pay that price. I mean, it's really a very small price for what you get. It's a very good deal. Very good sale. Give up something that you don't have anyway to get something authentic that you really are. But still, some people would rather hold on to the illusion that they're the master and controller of the universe. If you think about it, it's absurd, but you know, we'd rather hold on to that concept than that I'm a spiritual being, as Prabhupada would say, a servant of God. So especially now, nobody wants to be a servant. Why would anybody want to be a servant? But a loving servant, not a slave servant. Anyway, so Krishna wants to see that we're sincere. That we really want it. Why should he give us something that we don't want? Have you ever given a gift to someone that they didn't really want? How does that feel? Not very nice, is it? I mean, and sometimes it's a really nice gift. You might have spent a lot of time thinking about it. You spent a lot of money picking it out. You really thought about what would be nice for the person. And you give it to them and they say, thanks. Right? And then you say, what happened to that gift I gave you? I never see you using it. Right? I had a time once when I gave a friend of mine some very nice jewelry. Actually, when my husband and I entered the renounced order in 96, I gave away most of my jewelry at that time, and even some things that my mother had given me, really nice things, you know, real gold and lapis lazuli, beautiful things. And then one time I was visiting her house and I found the jewelry on the floor, covered with dust, you know, and mixed with toys, and some of it broken. And so do you think I ever gave that person anything really valuable again? What do you think? No, so Krishna's not such a fool. He finds out in advance if you're likely to use it nicely. Right? He finds out what you really want. So how does he see what you really want? He sees what you really want by what you do. So this process of bhakti that we're teaching in the Hare Krishna movement, we're not saying that by this process of bhakti, you're going to attain enlightenment by your own effort. It's not a mechanical process. There's four main ways of attaining love of God and spiritual realization. One way is detached work called karma pala tyaga. You do work in the world, very much the kind of work you would do anyway, but you do it for personal purification and for salvation. And it has to be done according to the scriptures. That's called karma yoga. Then there's gyan yoga. Gyan yoga means you study the philosophical parts of the Vedic scriptures, particularly the Upanishads. You don't engage in any ordinary work. You stop your ordinary work. You become basically like a monk or a nun. You leave ordinary life. A friend of mine showed me a few clips of a film of monks in France, I think, where they're silent all the time. Maybe you've heard of this. They only talk on Sundays. On Sundays, they go outside the monastery and they can talk. Otherwise, they don't speak at all week. And they're simply engaged in studying scripture and in praying. They don't do any external work. So that's gyan yoga. Then there's dhyan yoga. Dhyan yoga, again, you don't do any ordinary work in the world. You go away from the general mass of people and you engage in what's called astanga yoga, where you withdraw all of your senses from the world. You go into a state of inner trance where you're unaware of anything in the world. And in the state of trance, you meditate on the soul and the Supreme Soul within your heart. Now, all three of those processes, karma yoga, jnana yoga, and dhyana, or astanga yoga, They all also require grace. But they are also mechanical processes. They're primarily mechanical processes. You do this this way, and you do this that way, and you do this that way, and you'll get some result. Because this world is also created, and our bodies are created. So if we manipulate them in certain ways, then we can open the portals to salvation, to liberation. Sometimes that even happens circumstantially. Something happens to a person's body and they all of a sudden have some realization. Have you ever read about people like that? They got in some kind of accident or something happened and they had a realization of eternity. So that's true for those three processes. But first of all, those three processes are very, very difficult. It's very difficult to just do detached work. It's very difficult to leave the general mass of people and just study philosophy all the time. It's very difficult to leave the general mass of people and just do inner meditation. So most people doing that, they fail. They're not successful. And even those require some grace. Our practice of bhakti is very different. Our practice of bhakti gets to the root of our problem. Instead of just dealing with the material nature in a mechanical way, it gets to the whole essence. These other three processes also, you run the risk that even if you're successful, you haven't really dealt with the root, and so you go back. Even with some of our material habits, isn't like that sometimes? We give up a material habit for a while, but we haven't dealt with the root cause, and so we end up taking up the habit again. So those three processes have that risk to it. But bhakti yoga, we're going to the root, the very root, which is, do I want to be an illusory master and controller? Or do I want to be who I actually am, a lover of God, a servant of God? So they go to that directly. That directly we're approaching Krishna, and I want to fall in love with you again. I want to be in harmony with you again. I want to regain my original position. And that's acknowledging that our ultimate victory is dependent on grace. So our actions in bhakti are not in the mood of a controller. They're not in the mood of something mechanical that, well, if I chant a certain number of Hare Krishna mantras, or I offer a certain number of sticks of incense, or I do this particular ritual, that'll be pushing the right buttons and it'll open the door to my ultimate desire. No, it's not like that at all. We're saying I'm doing these behaviors simply to show Krishna that I want to change my mentality and I want to change my consciousness, and I'm depending on his grace. But this is he's throwing the rope and we grab it. It's not all that we just sit there, okay, put my fingers around the rope. And it's not simply that I'm climbing up the rope by my own effort. The rope is given to me by Krishna. So it's a very nice analogy by Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, the anniversary of whose birth in this world is today. And we're remembering that we have this knowledge passed down from teacher to disciple coming from Bhaktisiddhanta. So we have some time for questions and discussions, comments. Yes?
I've heard that you and to initiate people as scholar from Prabhupada, or there are some informations, I don't know. Are you able to initiate people?
Talking about me personally?
Mm-hmm.
No. That's your answer. Yes.
I would like to thank you about the point, Mataji, where you mentioned that the process or the rules and regulations are just to show Krishna our desire to go to him. I would like to ask, how important are those rules and regulations in an aspect of following them, and by doing this, maybe hurting other people? What is the priority, by your opinion? Is it more loving dealings between the people?
Why does there have to be a choice?
Sometimes we get into such situations.
It's interesting, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna really emphasizes that one has to be merciful to all living entities. And Krishna is Suridam Sarvabhutanam. He's the best friend of everyone. And a great soul, a devotee, is also supposed to be Suridam Sarvadehinam, the best friend of everyone. So I don't see how, generally speaking, it's possible to follow the rules of bhakti and knowingly, intentionally hurt others. We may sometimes hurt others unintentionally or without even being aware of it. I see we generally hurt others in three circumstances. One is where I don't know I'm hurting someone else at all. I'm not even aware of it. I've done something or said something that somebody was hurt by, but I have no awareness at all unless they tell me. That happened to me once when, in our school, one of my teachers asked me for some papers, so I made some copies and put it in a used envelope and put it on his desk. And the next day he said, "I have to leave." I said, "Why?" He said, "I didn't pay my taxes 1 year, and now the tax agency is coming after me." I said, "Oh, I'm very sorry." I said, "When did you find out?" He said, "Well, there was that envelope on my desk." And it was just a used envelope. I didn't realize I'd put it in an envelope from the tax agency. So sometimes we offend people without meaning to. Other times we offend people, and we know we're offending people, but we think that there's no other option. I'm thinking, in order to get something accomplished, in order to do something, I just have to kind of step on people, and I wish I didn't have to step on people, but I don't know any other way to do what I need to do. And the other one is when we intentionally hurt people. You know, when we think, okay, in order to get you to do something or whatever, I'm going to say something nasty to you, or I'm going to do something nasty. So that's probably the less often, but it does happen, that we may purposely do something to hurt people. So generally speaking, a practitioner of bhakti shouldn't want to hurt anyone. I mean, not even other humans. We shouldn't even, just like we're vegetarian. There's many reasons why we're vegetarian, but one is not to cause any unnecessary pain to anybody. And we don't even want to hurt little insects. You know, if there's some little insect, we don't just step on it and put it outside, put it someplace where it can get its food. So having said that, there's a very nice purport in Bhagavad Gita 9:30, where Krishna says that even if someone does something abominable, if they're rightly situated, they're still to be considered saintly. So Prabhupada explains what does that mean in his purport. He said, in this world we have two duties, one spiritual and one material. So material duties have to do with the body and mind that we have. Now we can spiritualize those activities, but still those activities are determined by the body and mind that we have. Whereas our spiritual activities are irrespective of the body and mind. So everyone has the same basic spiritual activities, but we all have different material activities. And Prabhupada says, usually those parallel one another. Usually you can spiritualize your material activities, and they can run in harmony with your spiritual activities. He said, but sometimes they're in opposition to one another. And when they're in opposition to one another, then a spiritual person may end up doing something that from a material point of view is not very nice. And an example of this is that for me, when I wanted to join the Hare Krishna movement, I had to disobey my mother. Now, my father encouraged me, but my mother didn't. My mother said, "I'm not, you know, you're not allowed." Of course, I was already an adult. But it's interesting because when I've met families from very traditional cultures, they would never think of opposing their parents in that way. I was speaking to a couple in South India where the family said, "You know, if you get initiated in the Hare Krishna movement, we'll commit suicide." And so they won't do it. They won't even consider doing it. Or even just the parents who say, "You know, we don't want you to do this," and they won't do it, even though they're 35, 40 years old. So to us in the West, that's inconceivable. You know, why do you have to obey your parents when you're 40 years old about what you want to do with your life? But in the old cultures, that was considered abominable, that your parents tell you to do this. So sometimes on the spiritual path, one may have to do something that materially is considered abominable. But generally speaking, We should not cause pain to any living entity in the name of our spiritual life. I mean, that's, what kind of spiritual life is that? Nor should we neglect the principles of bhakti to be nice to people. I mean, it shouldn't have to come to those sort of decisions. Now, if it does come to those sort of decisions, then we really need to save ourselves first. Prabhupada said, the highest principle is to save others, but higher than that is to save yourself. If you don't save yourself, you're not any good to anybody. You know, and sometimes saving yourself may require that other people are disappointed with you. It happens. What can be done? But we should do our best never to cause any harm directly, indirectly, any anxiety, any pain, anything. I mean, Krishna says, the great souls is he for whom no one is put into anxiety, and they're not put into anxiety by anybody else's actions. Whatever other people do, they're not disturbed, and they never intentionally disturb others. Does that help?
Yes.
What is the definition of bhakti? 6 hours doing bhajan, puja, that's all, or remembering God, and how can I progress in this?
Oh, very nice. Okay, definition of bhakti. So Rupa Goswami gives the definition, anya vilasita shunyam, gana karma anavritam, anukulena krishna anushilanam bhaktir uttamam. He also says, sarvapati vinirmuktan taparatena nirmala rishikesha rishikena sevanam bhaktir uchite. So he gives two definitions of bhakti. The first is that your material desires are zero. Material desires means, I want a better body, I want a different body, I want a different personality, I want more of this, I want less this, I want a different kind of this in this world. All the different ways I want to be the master and controller of the world. I want to master and control the world this way, and I want to master and control the world. That's gone. You're not cultivating that. And you're not covered by this karma and gyan. You're doing activities and you're getting spiritual knowledge, but as part of expressing love, not thinking that you're taking any mechanical process. Then you're doing shilanam, you're doing activities for Krishna on two levels, internally with the mood of devotion, externally with the action, anukulena, that are going to make Krishna happy. And that is bhakti. So activities of the heart, of the body, that make Krishna happy, that are not covered by any idea that I'm the doer of karma and gyan, and that without desire for being a master and controller in the world. Now, by the way, if I do have a desire to be a master and controller in the world, it's better to talk to Krishna about it than to go to Krishna and say, I don't have any desire to be a master and controller in the world. If it's not true, it doesn't work very well with him. But it's more like, you know, Krishna, I'm really sorry. I still have these desires to be a master and control in the world. I know they're not good for me. Please help me to deal with them and help me to come to a point where I don't have them anymore. Then the other definition, sarvapati vinirmuktam, to be free of these designations, thinking I'm man, I'm woman, I'm old, I'm young, I'm Indian, I'm German, I'm Peruvian, I'm whatever. You know, I have this and that duty in the world. And to try to satisfy Krishna's senses with my senses. Now, this doesn't mean I don't do anything in the world, but it means I do things for a very different purpose. And in fact, it was also Bhakti Siddhanta who said, it said this in the purport to Brahma Samhita, text 61, that you start putting your money into Krishna's account. And of course, you could do that literally with money, but he's not really talking about literal money. Just like normally in a family, you're married, right? Okay, so you try to serve your husband and make him happy. Correct? Okay. Is he always happy with you? He's always happy. Is this your husband? Yes, your husband. Are you always happy with her?
That would be a blessing.
Okay. So it's not possible. It's not possible. You know, and one day you may make some nice food and the next day you cook the same food and maybe one day he liked it, one day he didn't like it. This is life. Okay? So if I'm thinking I'm serving my husband, and if my husband is happy with me, that's my happiness. That's material. If I'm thinking I'm serving my husband so Krishna will be happy with me, then that's, you're putting it into Krishna's account. Now, in fact, you will probably serve your husband nicer Because if I'm serving my husband so my husband will be happy with me, then if he's not happy with me, I may become disappointed. And then I may become unhappy. This happens sometimes in relationships, right? You know, I'm trying to make my wife happy. I bought her something, and she goes, oh, I don't really like it. And then I'm not happy. And then I think, well, I'm not going to get anything for her anymore. Do you follow? But if I'm doing something for my husband or my wife or my children or my friends to make Krishna happy, then even if my husband isn't always happy, or my wife isn't always happy, or my children aren't always happy, which is definitely going to be the case, then I'm not discouraged. Does that make some sense to you? Okay, so that's what it means, sarvapadiva nirmukta antaparatena nirmala. That I'm no longer doing things because I'm a wife, because I'm a woman, because I'm a this, because I'm a that. I don't have, those designations are no longer pushing my behavior. That's not my identity anymore. I'm not thinking I'm acting this way because I'm a good German. It may be the same action, but I'm thinking I'm acting in this way so Krishna will smile. It's quite different. The mentality is quite different. And if you're doing things so that Krishna will be happy, then you can be happy in all circumstances, even when materially things don't work out very well. Now, another way you can understand bhakti is by the... Those are your basic definitions of bhakti. By the activities of bhakti. The activities of bhakti have been explained by Rupa Goswami as 64 different activities. Not that one has to do all of them, but he has a list of 64. He says of the 64, three are very important. That is finding a guru, serving the guru, and taking initiation from the guru. And he says five are the most powerful: to chant the holy name, to worship the deity, to live in a holy place or make where you live a holy place, to associate with devotees, and what did I forget? Yes, thank you. The scriptures, to study the scriptures, especially the Bhagavatam. So those are the most powerful. So the three most important and the five most powerful. And those 64, including the three most powerful, the five most powerful and the three most important, can be categorized into nine categories of hearing about Krishna, chanting about Krishna, talking about Krishna, or chanting, remembering Krishna, which is a kind of meditation, serving the lotus feet of Krishna, which means doing things in relationship to Krishna, going to holy places, serving the devotees, worshipping the deity, offering obeisances, offering prayers, becoming Krishna's friend. Krishna says he's our friend, but one way of bhakti is becoming Krishna's friend. Thinking about what he wants, right? Doing things for him. And surrendering everything. Surrendering everything then has six categories. You remember all this? We need a diagram, right? We need definition of bhakti, nine categories, 64 items, three most important, five most powerful, right? And then in those nine categories, the total surrender. So that has another six categories. At least it's very scientific. It's not just, you know, oh, just love God. How do I do that? I don't know. Yeah. It's very detailed. So the six categories of surrender are accepting what's favorable to loving Krishna, rejecting what's not favorable, seeing that Krishna is your only maintainer, Krishna is your only protector, always expecting his mercy, and being meek and humble. And then we could talk about what each of those means. What does it mean to be humble? Does that just mean to go, oh, I'm not very good at anything? What exactly does that mean? You could also understand bhakti, like I was saying, as you mentioned also, that it's the way of showing Krishna that I'm serious and sincere. Okay? Let's put it the other way. So maybe we've had somebody in our life who was a friend or even a family member, and someone we trusted, someone we had a relationship with, and then they did something that really hurt us. They cheated us in some way. They dealt with us in a way that wasn't very nice. And maybe it was really bad. And we just thought, you know, I can't trust this person anymore. Okay? So then the person after a while comes back and says, I'm really sorry, I'd like to have my relationship back. So are you going to just immediately give them back the relationship? No. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? So you have some friend or family member.
Put him on trial.
Put them on trial, exactly. You know? So I knew one woman whose husband was a gambler. She said she never knew when she came home from work if there was going to be a house there to come home to. So one day she'd have a really nice house, the next day she'd be living with relatives, and one day she'd have a nice car, and the next day she wouldn't have any car. It was driving her crazy. You know, and her husband would say, I'm going to give it up. I mean, at a certain point, she threw him out of the house. And then he'd say, I'm going to give it up. Well, she's just going to say, oh, that's great. Why don't you come back? No, there's going to be some test. And they say, well, you need to do this and this and this and this and this. You know, I have somebody like that right now in my life, where I've had to say to this person, okay, if you want to deal with me, you've got to do these two things. And when you do those two things, then I'll communicate with you again. Until you've done those things, I'm not going to communicate with you anymore. So the rules of bhakti are something like that. That Krishna's saying, okay, you want to come back to your spiritual position. You want, again, to have your original spiritual loving relationship. Okay, these are the things that you've got to do. And at a certain point, you let the other person back in. And sometimes you may kind of, you know, it's not an all or nothing. You know, sometimes you watch what the other person's doing and you may try. You follow? You know, they've started to do what you've asked them to do, so you test it a little bit. With this person I've asked to do, I've tested several times with her. That I've said, okay, you know, I'll let you back in a little bit. And then she immediately does the same things again. And then I have to say, oh no, wait again. And then some months go by and I say, oh, okay, I'll let you in a little bit. Now, if you let the person in a little bit and you see that you can trust them a little bit, then you may let them in a little bit more. So Krishna also does that. That's why sometimes when we're chanting, when we're in kirtan, or we're chanting japa, or we're reading the books, or we're eating the prasadam, we have some incredible spiritual experience. That's Krishna opening the door a little bit and saying, can I trust you? How are you going to be? Okay, I'm going to reach out to you. And how do we respond? And depending on how we respond, you know, we may do more, and eventually he'll open the door and let us in. You know, and he'll open the door and let us in. This is described in the 10th canto, second chapter, that there's a big ocean. Often material entanglement is compared to an ocean. You know, very big, very difficult, something you can't swim across. And on the side of the ocean, there's a boat, which is carried across all the saintly persons. And that boat is Krishna's lotus feet. So the question is asked, well, if it's carried across all the saintly persons, why is it still there? Because, you know, if the boat takes them across, then the boat also goes. And the answer is given that, well, no, they don't actually have to cross the ocean in a boat. As soon as they approach the boat, then the whole ocean shrinks to a tiny little puddle. Like if a big dog was walking in mud and left a paw print and the rain filled up the mud, a little tiny puddle, which you can walk over without even being aware that it's there. So we don't have to achieve everything on our own. It's when we get to a certain point, we actually approach the boat, then immediately everything is done. Now, how can you progress? Okay, how can you progress? Is everybody interested in this?
Yes.
Okay. So I see that in the Bhagavad Gita, there's four steps that happen. The first step is that Arjuna comes close to Krishna. He says, Krishna, I want to be your disciple. Then, so that's what Arjuna does. He does that. He comes close to Krishna. He takes himself to Krishna. Then Krishna instructs. He says, this is what you are, this is what I am, this is what illusion is. And then at the end of Krishna's instruction, what does he say to Arjuna? Now you do what you like. I met one gentleman who said, that's my favorite verse of the Bhagavad Gita. Now you do whatever you like. He said, I follow that every day. So at the end of Krishna's instruction, then he says to Arjuna, okay, I've given you knowledge, now you choose. So then Arjuna has to choose. Then Krishna says, depending on what you choose, he says, if you choose rightly, I will help you. Right? I will bring you to success, I will enlighten you, and if you choose wrongly, you will be deluded. Okay? So Arjuna comes close to Krishna. Krishna enlightens, instructs, illumines. Arjuna chooses. And then after Arjuna chooses, then Krishna brings him to success. Does that make sense? Okay? So what do we have to do? There's two things we have to do. One, we have to come close to Krishna. So if you want to progress, come closer to Krishna. That means increasing quantity or quality. So if right now you're chanting the holy name on beads, you can chant more or chant better with more attention. Engage in more kirtan or do kirtan with more attention. Read the books more or read them with more attention. Do some more service or do the service you're doing now with more attention, with more care. Somehow get yourself closer to Krishna in quantity or quality. Then what will happen? Jnana dipena bhaspita. Krishna will reveal in your heart. He'll show you. Here I am, here you are, here's illusion. He'll show you. He'll make things very clear to you. You'll understand, oh, this is illusion, this is reality, and here I am. Then you have to choose. You have to choose. So as you engage in the process of bhakti, things will become clear to you. Then you have to make choices. And then as you choose, then Krishna will bring you up to the next step. So if you want to progress in bhakti, get close to Krishna. And when he reveals to you what you should do, your next step, do it. Don't be afraid. Many times Krishna reveals to us what our next step is, and we say, no, I can't do that. I don't want to do that. If I do that, so many terrible things will happen. And we back off. Okay, so what I've seen is that if we consistently choose illusion, then it becomes harder and harder to be closer to Krishna. Because Krishna is like the sun. You know, when you're in the sun, you see everything clearly. It's hard to make bad choices if you see everything clearly. It's possible, but it's difficult. You understand? So if you really want to make bad choices, then you're not going to want to be in a position where you see everything clearly. So if you keep making bad choices when Krishna reveals, then you're going to find it harder and harder to do the activities of bhakti with care and attention. Does that make sense to everybody? You know, if you don't want to clean your room, it's easier to not turn the light on. If you turn on the light, you feel obligated to clean up the mess. You know, or if you open the closet door or whatever. Okay? Anything else? Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Jaya.